tell us the worst Christmas.
Hello, and welcome to episode 53 of If This Is a Podcast, Then What's Christmas? Today, I'm speaking to Matt Follows, who was an award-winning creative, started around the same time I did in the mid-90s, and went on to work at M&C Saatchi when it was a startup, and White & Kennedy when it was a startup in one of its interesting iterations, and then when it sort of got on its feet and became something of the White & Kennedy we all know and love. But then Matt decided that he wanted to take a different path and go into the area of coaching, specifically in the area of, I guess, the mental health of creative leaders and helping them to deal with the stress and fear and insecurity and, you know, mental difficulties that go with being put in that position and what that entails. So, unusually, he went off and started training for that and, you know, very formal qualifications, got completely trained up in all areas of that, and then was able to be that kind of coach from a perspective of someone who's been there in that part of the business, which I think is really unusual. I've had various bits of coaching and things like that over the years, and there's always this little perception kind of hanging over the whole thing that you're talking to someone who doesn't really know what you're talking about, who knows the emotional side of what you're talking about, but doesn't know what it really means to be on a tight deadline with your CD or have three pieces of work turned down already and what's going to happen with the fourth one and what's happening with the jobs and how is the industry being fragmented and what does that mean for your own job security and can you pay the mortgage? All those things that we all know and love from working in advertising at the moment. So that's the chat we have. Part of the reason we spoke is because Matt is writing a book on this subject, which he is going through a website, which means that if he gets enough people to pre-order the book, it has a much higher chance of being picked up by a proper publisher. And I think a book like this would be a fantastic resource for people working in the industry and in other creative industries. So feel free, when you've listened to our chat, to have a look back at the blog post that I put up and the links that are on there so that you can go and find his book and please pre-order it to help it exist. And I think about $20 or however much it costs investment here may well save you an enormous amount of money somewhere else, or if not you, then another person. So please bear that in mind and enjoy our chat. Thank you. So hi, Matt. Lovely to speak to you. How are you today?
I'm very well, thank you, Ben. Very well, very hot here. Hey, it was very hot in the UK too.
Yeah, hang on, where are you?
I'm actually in Mallorca at the moment, so it's kind of like 40 degrees and not very pleasant.
Oh, well, I'm in LA and it's still pleasant, but it's like in the 90s. We're having a little bit of even LA heat wave right now. So
yeah,
it's hot everywhere.
Yeah, it is. It is global warming. It's got to love it.
Yeah, we can talk about I think global warming has been completely misbranded as a thing, because we like warm things, don't we? Warm is nice. So yeah. When they say global warming, no one's like freaked out by it. You're like, oh, warm, okay, that's good.
Yeah, kind of thank yourself for those aerosols you used when you were a kid.
Exactly, or not, when we all die a heat death. Anyway, that's not what we're here to talk about. We're here to, to discuss, I think, your perspective really on, looking at the advertising or creative advertising side of things from the mental health perspective, or look at the mental health things from the creative advertising perspective, whichever you like, the combination of those two things, which is what's your kind of unique USP in terms of, I think, having a chat and saying things that might be of massive interest to a lot of people in the industry. Because we'll get into this in more detail as soon as I stop this one little monologue here. But you've been a successful creative, and I think that's what gives you a really fantastic perspective on this, because I've done bunches of all sorts of coaching and advice and things like that, but it's always from someone who hasn't actually done the job. So the fact that you have, I think, gives you a really, really fantastic position to be able to offer advice in a way that probably is a little bit more insightful for those of us who might require it. Is that fair?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, that's the thing. When I started coaching, or even before I started coaching, the reason I came into it, because I was from that industry. I am from that industry, spent 20 years in it. So I kind of know intimately what people are going through. I know intimately what my clients are going through. I know the pain they've gone through. I know the kind of successes they've gone through. And I know the way through it as well. So I've had my struggles as well. I've had my down points. I've had my couple of burnouts that I've had, or I found out later they were burnouts, and come back through it. So it's very much that perspective. I think a lot of coaches out there. There's a hell of a lot of coaches out there, millions of coaches out there. But I guess the difference is, it's always best, certainly from my perspective, it's always best to work with someone who knows what you've been through and who knows what you're going through. So you don't have to waste a ton of time talking about your problems. You don't need to waste a ton of time expressing what that means to your life outside of the job and inside of the job. We could just get straight to the good stuff, essentially, which is making you better and making you more creative, more better leader, etc., etc.
That makes a lot of sense. Just so everyone's got a background to your kind of bona fides about who you are. I mean, you haven't just been a creative, you've been a really good creative in really good agencies. So should we just do a little bit of why and how you ended up working in advertising, and then go a little bit through the start of your career?
Yeah, absolutely. So I got into advertising because of psychology. I was kind of one of those kind of nerdy little kids who, when everyone else was reading Peter and Jane books, I was reading Grey's Anatomy. Not the film Grey's Anatomy, I was reading the manual on the brain, the body, etc., etc. And I was always fascinated with things like Freud and Jungian therapy and all that kind of stuff. I don't know why, but I always was fascinated by it. And what actually got me into advertising in the first place wasn't the artistic side or the writing side. It was the psychology of how can we influence human behaviour. So I remember the thing that really kind of like twisted the kind of like the lever into going to advertising was a book called, by Vance Packard, called The Hidden Persuaders.
Yeah, I've read that.
Brilliant book. And I loved it. I thought, wow, this is amazing. So you can actually work in an industry that kind of blends psychology with the fact that with art and writing and stuff. So I kind of, at school, I was good at art and I was crap at writing. I became a copywriter, but I was actually really bad at writing. I remember I failed English and the English teacher said I'd be no good as a writer. Couldn't do it. But I found out there was money in it, so I learned how to do it. And so that's how I got into it. So I got into it through that. Then I went to Art Foundation course in Burton. Did art. Halfway through, my lecturer, a guy called Les, basically pulled me to one side and essentially says, "You'll make no fucking money in art, man." And I was like, "Well, I'm from a council estate. I need to escape the hood." Essentially, I was like, "Well, I'm from Birmingham. How do I go then? What do I do? I don't know what I'm going to do." And he says, "Well, you want to work in advertising, because if you work in advertising, you earn loads and loads of money and you get massive bonuses for Christmas." And that swayed me. I was like, okay, wow, I'm going to study advertising. So left foundation and decided to try and find where was the best place at the time to study advertising. Where can I learn this kind of this art of making loads of money? So I went to Buckinghamshire College under Dave and went there for 3 years and studied advertising. Loved it, absolutely loved it. I kind of drifted off the psychology side there. As what tends to happen, I kind of got more into the craft of writing. So I remember going into libraries and reading all the books on all the annuals about. I was reading all the Nike ads and all the Adidas ads and all the stuff I kind of loved with those kind of things and Chivas Regal and all those kind of things. Massively into all of that. So I thought, okay, I'm going to be a copywriter again. I became a copywriter because people say that's how you become a creative director. Don't know if that's true, probably isn't true, but I thought I'm going to become a copywriter, even though the English teacher said I won't be a writer. So I studied that like crazy. And then myself and my partner, Chris, when we left Bucks, we got offered the job after a few placements. We got offered the job at M&C Saatchi, which at the time was pretty much unknown. It was a startup, so it wasn't the big global thing that they are now. It was bricks and tarpauling. I think there was about 20-odd people. And they were massively passionate about making brilliant work. So for us, 21-year-olds, going into that industry, absolutely loved it. Did that for 4 years, won some awards, got some cans and stuff, and gold for British Airways. And the person we'd worked under, our creative director, who I was kind of hero worshipped him from back at uni when I was looking at the ads that he wrote, Tony Barry, and he moved to a place called Wieden and Kennedy, which again at the time was another place that no one had really heard of. I remember certain press magazines were very much against it, very much against the agency. Europe was pretty much against the agency. But I joined that and it was a complete and utter, how can you say it? It was a bit of a mess.
Was this the time when, like, Adam Keane was... Because it went through three or four different goes that didn't quite work and before Tony and Kim showed up.
Yeah, so it's kind of Adam had just left and Tony had taken over a CD. I think Sue was there as well. And it was good. I mean, it was really interesting because we were really young and they basically said, take a big pay cut, come and work for us and work on Nike. And like, you're in your 20s, you kind of think, well, that makes total and utter sense. Why wouldn't you want to work on the best brand on the planet, or certainly the best brand on the planet that we thought it was? But when we got there, there were no briefs. There wasn't a great deal of opportunity. But then Tony and Kim joined probably about a year later with Amy, and it really started to find its feet. It started to get really excited. And not any of us knew it was getting exciting. We were just like heads down, just churning away at the work. But it started to get really exciting then. Then it became, as it became, a pretty special place to be.
Okay. And then is this the point where you started transitioning in or started doing some stuff more in the psychotherapy world?
Yeah, absolutely. So we'd done Nike Run London, we'd done the Book of Dreams and things like that, and been working on that. And it was a really exciting time. But that was the time when the psychology side of me started to kick back in, and I started to think I really want to start moving more into that kind of field. So I did what every creative kind of seems to do. I kind of quit the agency and became a commercials director. I don't really know why. So I started directing commercials. I did that for a while, but that was, I think it was in 2003. But I mean, as you know, when you're directing commercials, especially if you're not Frank Budgen and you're not kind of a big name, you've got a lot of time on your hands between pitching for stuff. So I thought, okay, well, why don't I then go back to what I really, really was passionate about with psychology? And I actually started studying NLP, neuro-linguistic programming, basically just to dip my toe in the water. And I absolutely loved it. I thought it's absolutely amazing. And it started to resonate with myself because when I was at Wieden's, I mean, it was a brilliant time to be there, but it was a very, 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 very intense time to be there. I mean, it was 4 years of, don't remember having many holidays. We worked very, very hard because the opportunity to create brilliant work. And I realised that I had kind of got to a point without knowing it where I was starting to burn out. So when I started going to NLP and learning this stuff, I thought, hang on a second, this is a really interesting way of me to start getting better, essentially. And not just starting to get better mentally, just starting to get better at what I was doing and starting to find myself again, because I'd lost myself. I didn't know what was up or down, to be honest. So I did that. And then after doing NLP, I went to King's College London and I started studying psychotherapy. I started studying peak performance psychology, clinical hypnotherapy, and that basically went on for about 10 years where I studied absolutely everything I could about the human brain again and about high performance. And it was an amazing time, pretty much. It was an incredible time. And I didn't really tell anyone I was doing it either.
And was it difficult to get into those courses? I mean, was, you know, applying and stuff? I mean, I think if anyone in any way is thinking of doing this now and following your path, would they go, oh, I've got no background or qualifications in that. Can I get on and start to learn that in the same, as smoothly as you did?
I think the difference was, I think there's two things. Is one, it was a long time ago. So 2003 is what, like over 15 years ago. So it was easier then to kind of make these kind of transitions. I think also I was young and stupid enough to make that kind of transition. You got to have something that's slightly screw loose to kind of jump from a really good career and then go, I'm going to start and be a student again. But I think also really helps to be from advertising, because I kind of managed to blag myself on it through all the stuff I learned in advertising. So the lecturer on those courses wanted me to be on there, and I remember actually going to her actual house in Balham and being interviewed there, because I didn't do the foundation to get onto it, but we had like a couple of hours chat, and then she says, yeah, I'd love to have you on there. So you can do it if you've got enough of the drive to do it, and you've got enough impetus, and you're willing to sacrifice some stuff. Yeah, I think you can do it, totally, and I would recommend it.
Okay, so I guess from this point we should talk about, I guess, like mental health and what the business is like and all this kind of stuff in those terms. My experience, I mean, I actually did my degree in social psychology, so yep. I had some of that background a little bit myself as well, and I think that sort of interest in human nature and what makes us tick is part of kind of, you know, part of the job and part of what kind of drives people to maybe be interested in, to say it as charitably as possible, maybe manipulating people into, maybe that's not the right word, but persuading people into a certain direction. So if you're into that, then that might lead you to this career. But I have my own personal theories about some of this, and maybe just in mentioning some of it, you can tell me how wrong I am and what the actual right thing is. But I have a small theory here that, so if you're a young creative team, you're kind of chucked in at the deep end, sort of sink or swim. There isn't like a kind of learning process where you gently walk up the steps until 5 years in, you're given a TV brief and you're then allowed to make it and whatever. I have this sort of feeling that you kind of get in and, you know, maybe you don't make a TV ad in your first couple of years, maybe you do, I don't know. But there's a weird subconscious perception that's difficult to ignore, that there's a lot riding on your shoulders. Like you turn up as a 22, 23 year old or whatever, and suddenly, particularly if you go on a shoot, all these vans have turned up and all these people who are much better paid than you and richer than you and whatever are doing things based off what you say. And I think on the surface, it's quite exciting. And underneath, without you perhaps recognizing it because it's so exciting, you're going, Jesus Christ, all this stuff's happening because of me. If I make a little step in the wrong direction, you know, there's companies who have trusted me with the launch of a new product. There's a director asking me questions about whether we should do this shot or that shot. There's an edit. There's my creative director. Do you think that can be the case? Because I think on the surface, it's a lot of fun and it's really cool and it's why we're making this fun stuff. But underneath, the responsibility is a bigger deal than I think we really talk about.
Yes, I do. It is 100%. And I think that's kind of the difference between being young and when we kind of get older, is that when we're kind of younger and kind of in our kind of early 20s, we do experience this excitement. We have that kind of buzz, that kind of like, wow, I can't believe I'm doing this job. I can't believe this is even better than uni, et cetera, all these people are here and wow, they're listening to me. I think what happens is that as we get older, that turns into anxiety. So it's actually, you're actually better off when you are a young creative, because you've got less fears around you. Just being young, you've got less fear around you about what this could potentially mean if you make this work or if you don't make this work. But as you get older, you've still got that stuff, but you don't feel it as excitement. You feel that as anxiety. So I think we do have it. I'm not sure it's as big a deal when you're younger, though. I mean, I know when we were doing our first stuff, it was a buzz. It was an absolute exciting thing. The switch came personally when I felt it. It was when I became a director, and then the anxiety came. I mean, it was awesome afterwards when you kind of get into it, but the anxiety, like, oh my God, what the hell have I done? I've kind of written this treatment and all these people are now here and these lorries are here and this food is here and shit, the creative director's here and the creatives are here and I know them and I hope I don't mess this thing up. So I think when you're younger, you've got more ball space, you've got less fear.
That's interesting. The reason I brought that up is because when I started at AMV, and that was a couple of years into my career, so maybe I was 2 or 3 years in, there was this one point where I walked into my office in the morning. My art director hadn't got in yet. And I don't know what happened. I mean, I guess we can talk about what you were alluding to as a breakdown earlier on. But I crawled under my desk and I started to cry. And I was like, what the fuck? I didn't know why. I didn't know where it was coming from. And then my art director came in. And I think naturally he was a bit freaked out. And he said, maybe you need to get some help. I don't know what, I can't remember exactly what he said. But as soon as he said it, I got up and left and went to talk to somebody or whatever. And then I think I had a chat with some of the guys in the after, some other younger creatives. Because at AMV, it was a very sort of superstar mature agency and they hadn't had many young people in there. And I don't know what it was. But then when I was speaking to another guy who was at my kind of level, he said he'd had the same thing. I think he said he sat in traffic and suddenly had to kind of stop his car and he started crying for no reason as well. And the weird thing is, nothing like that's ever happened to me since. And I've felt very chilled since, even though I've been in much more responsible positions. And that's why I was wondering if there was some element, because we were making tons of stuff then, and all the things that I just mentioned to you before were happening like constantly. And I remember thinking, why is it now? And like I said, in the 20 years since, nothing like that's ever happened to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's partly because we got like, there's two types of fear we have. And the most dangerous one is the unconscious. We have conscious fear where we know what we're fearing. And then we have unconscious fear, which we're fearing it, but we don't know what we're fearing. Worse than that, we don't feel the fear as through that. If we have conscious fear, we feel it in our bodies, that kind of adrenaline, that cortisol. And we can kind of pinpoint it and say, oh, it's that that I'm worried about. When you're younger, you don't tend to have that. You have this fear bubbling up, this unconscious stuff. Am I good enough? Am I worthy? Do I deserve to be here, et cetera, et cetera? If that bubbles up, you often don't know what you're crying about. You just don't know. And it's kind of it's a huge amount of pressure. I think also slight difference is that from where I started, because MNC was a startup when we joined it, and then we kind of grew with it, and then Wieden & Kennedy was a startup and we grew with it. Even though it was a kind of a superstar place, it became those kind of places. We didn't really feel that pressure. If you got to someone like AMV, I mean, you've got legends there from day dot. I think the pressure to perform is externally more present. I think when you're in somewhere that's like a startup place, it's just that there's more of a kind of everyone mucks in because no one knows how this thing's going to go. So I think the pressures are different. But I think if you walked into somewhere that's an established place that's got a huge reputation and got huge people who work there, the pressures are going to build up. I mean, you're young and it's kind of like you're thinking, shit, there's a lot riding on this. And if it's unconscious stuff, you don't know what beliefs are bubbling up there and kind of like just taking over. And they will and they can and they do. It's happening more and more though now as well. I mean, I think it's happened because I mentor for the SCA as well and I do some stuff with those guys. And what I used to do when we were doing like book crits, I don't remember young creatives feeling as much pressure. They felt a lot of excitement about getting into the industry. But when I now look at students who are transitioning to go into the industry, they're feeling massive amounts of pressure because the industry's feeling all the pressure. You don't have to walk into an agency these days and you can feel it. I mean, it's kind of like you used to walk into a creative department and feel a buzz of excitement and it was kind of mental and there were really loud characters and crazy characters. You walk into them now and it's like a bank.
That's a really interesting transition. I mean, it's funny that you and I started at pretty much the same time. And I do remember feeling like it was much more of a, for want of a better word, more of a laugh in the mid-90s when, you know, the idea of working on a Friday afternoon was weird because we were all drunk by Friday lunchtime. And that was accepted. And that was like, yeah, of course we're all drunk by Friday lunchtime. And, you know, if you said, oh, should we just go to the pub or go to the movies, stuff, and it was not a weird thing. And it was like, yeah, of course, let's take the time off and go and do that. And now it feels so much more of a business. And I think with people, people want to get their money's worth out of you, out of whatever asset they have. And I think that there's instead of saying, you know, are you good and can we nurture you and can we improve your craft? It's like, what are you producing? Is it worth having you on my balance sheet? And are you justifying your salary? And I think it's very difficult as a creative person, particularly in, you know, advertising is a unique place where kind of creativity meets commerce. And I think what you've got then is this idea that money is always this looming figure behind you when what you're trying to do is create a version of art. Do you think that kind of discrepancy ends up being problematic for people?
I think it's huge. I think that's the biggest problem that we face as an industry. Is that, I mean, the clue's in the name, isn't it? We used to be the creative industry, but the creative was the big word. Now we're the creative industry, and creative is the little word. The industry is the big word. And I remember the shift at M&C, and it was 1999. Great tune. But I do remember it went suddenly from, I work with creative people, but I also work with strategy, accounting, all that kind of side of stuff. So not against that then, but I do remember there was this difference where it was like the creatives ran this show, and that was, they were the ones who were responsible for the success of the business. And I do remember that shift when it suddenly felt like we were the ones with the spotlight on us, but more spotlight, the kind of hot light on us, and it was accountants who started running the show. And I think what happened is that suddenly, as a business, someone realised, actually, there's a bucket load of money to be made out of these human beings. Let's do that. And that's when I think the kind of like the heroes of the industry started to be squashed out a bit. And I think part of the reason, when we talk about the 90s the industry was so much fun. I mean, it was so exciting. I mean, you could not believe that you would get a job that was more mental than being at university or college. Or school or whatever, and then he went to we were able to blow off steam. Essentially, we could leave our desks, we had offices, we could hunker down and probably cut this out of the smoke pot or whatever. And then it became open plan, and that everyone's looking at you, and it is the balance sheet. That's a hell of a lot of pressure to put on anyone. If you've grown up in that kind of earlier phase, and then you're still in it because you're now running those agencies or chief officers of those agencies or et cetera, et cetera, I think you feel the pressure even more because you're trying to get, I've got no escape from it. I'm constantly under the spotlight. And I remember one of my clients said that it's weird that when you become a creative leader of a place, you're the kind of like this kind of like superhuman who's going to come in and fix something. But he was saying that what happens is you've got a spotlight on your front and a target on your back. And he goes, that is a huge amount of pressure to take. And if you can't blow that steam off because you can't leave your desk, etc., how can you balance it out? And I think we used to be able to balance it out in the old days. We could go for a walk around other people's offices.
Yeah.
I remember people be asleep in their offices, just completely and utterly comatose in their offices after lunch and stuff. That was cool, as long as they hit the deadline and did some brilliant work. It was kind of cool. Now that's not acceptable. I think that's part of the problem. If you look at things like film, TV, music and stuff, I suspect a lot of those great artists aren't sitting in an open plan office being watched all the time. I suspect they're probably getting hammered.
I suspect you're right. And my old art director used to, we had these brilliant toilets at AMV on the sixth floor, because it's a management floor, so only like three people use them. And Peter Mead had his own loo, so he wasn't going to use them. But we had really good toilet roll as well. So my art director would go down to the sixth floor men's toilet and just lean on the really comfy toilet roll and have a nap in the middle of the afternoon. And that's what it was like. Anyway, that aside, yes, blowing off steam was part and parcel of, you know, what went on at that time. But I'd just like to ask...
Now we pay thousands of pounds for consultants to come in and tell us that we need to build a meditation room.
Yeah, and just, I think what you're saying about...
sleep on some comfy bob roll.
Yeah, open plan offices are definitely a thing where you feel like you can't hide. And it's not hide so you can just goof off. It's hide so you can have any kind of respite from being 100% available at all times. And if anyone looks across the room, are you at your desk? And if you're not at your desk, what are you doing? Because there's a sort of automatic perception that if you're not at your desk, you're doing something, inverted commas, frivolous. So you're down the pub, or you've gone home early, or any of those things. And some of them might be very helpful, and some of them might not be the case. You might have gone around to talk to someone. But I think you're right. The open plan office, and which is obviously a consequence of the money side of things. Well, I remember we in some agencies I've talked about where they said, well, it's 18 inches of desk space per person or whatever it was. And then we used to have 22 inches of desk space per person, but now it's 18, so we can fit more people in. And you're like, oh, my God, this is like the cages for birds that make, eggs, the birds you find in supermarkets. And it's like, it's all right, we can squish some more people in by giving you less and less and less and less and less. And there'll be no consequence to it. And I think because the consequence of it is supposed creativity, which can't be measured empirically, you have to kind of go, are the ads better? Are the ads worse? I don't know. What's your opinion? And it happened with the rise of data. That so many things have happened at the same time. It's been very, very difficult to say what's the cause of it? What's gone wrong? Is it one thing or is it five different things? And is it the combination of those five different things actually making each other worse? Do you feel like that's been the case?
Yeah, I think gut instinct has been kicked out and untrusted, because how can you measure gut instinct? One of my clients said, you can't take a leap of faith off a balance sheet. Makes total sense. It's kind of like what creativity is, isn't it? And it's kind of what's happened is we've started battery farming creativity and battery farming creative human beings. You're not going to get happy chickens, do you know what I mean? They're not going to lay golden eggs. They're going to lay some mass-formed, horrible things. It just isn't going to work. I mean, I just don't believe it. I mean, the proof is it's not working. We're losing great talent. I mean, I remember, you'll remember, it's kind of the days when to get a job used to be really, really difficult. You talked about in your recent blog post, about people be lining around the block to get your job at that agency. They're not doing it now. When I talk to students, and I remember the last time I spoke to a bunch of students, they were about to graduate, and I says, what agencies do you want to work at? Only about 5% named anyone. And I thought, what's weird? What's that? And everyone else said, I'm only learning advertising because I've got a startup business idea, and I've realised that advertising is the most expensive part. So if I learn how to do it and invest these 8 months, I'll be able to launch my business.
That is fascinating. Oh, my God. I didn't realise that was a thing. Wow.
It's a worry, isn't it? I mean, it's great. I mean, the college is still getting people in, but the agencies aren't. And why would you?
Yeah, and I mean, I've written about it several times that, even if it wasn't that you want to make your own startup, that, you might be more inclined to go to Google or Facebook or someone's in-house department, because, when you and I started, you could name 5 to 10 agencies that you'd kill to work at. Whether it was Lowe at that time was amazing, AMV at that time was amazing, Saatchi & Saatchi was producing incredible work at that time.
Yep.
And the list just kind of went on, and I think through the early part of 2000s, it was still the case, Mother or whoever it happened to be. And then, everything's become much more fragmented. So are you the social part of a big agency, or are you a social agency? And if you do a social ad, no one knows or really cares about it, in terms of fame or glamour or anything like that. You don't get to go, oh, well, I'm going on a shoot with Frank Budgeon. We're off to Mexico to do this, and everyone's going to see it in the cinema in front of, whatever movie it is. That's all left the business as well. So maybe we're straying a little bit far from mental health, but I think all these things have combined to either feed into, why people aren't interested or how people are feeling in terms of how they do their job in 2018 as opposed to 1996.
I think it all does feed into it, because I think all of these things do loop into the fact, well, why is there a problem in the industry now? Why are people not having like a long-term career? Why are people kind of, it used to be if you had a young creative and you met them 10 years later, they would start getting, oh, I'm a bit disillusioned with the industry. I can't change the world like I thought I could 10 years ago. Why is it now you meet those same people, different people, but same age, 2 years later and they're at that point? I can't change the world. This isn't going to work for me. I'm going to go and do something else. So I think it is that thing. If you take the fun out of it, you take the fun out of life, you start getting problems, mental problems. And I think what's happened is because there's less sense of control. We used to have a sense of control. We used to feel like we had a sense of control of our own destiny back in the day, it did feel like we had that. If you take away that sense of control, that sense of kind of I know where this is going, that sense of clarity, that sense of purpose, then I think what's happened is that people, they lose their sense of self. They lose a sense of purpose. They lose a sense of perspective. That's what happened to me. And that happened to me. I mean, it happened to me, but at least it happened after a decade. Now people, that's happened a lot earlier. I remember I did a study, and it was probably in 2012, because I was moving. I kind of rejected creativity, and I rejected creative people, because I'd gone through my own stuff. I kind of thought, well, the problem is creativity. If I didn't think so bloody much, I'd be much happier. Mm. So I kind of did the psychology stuff to get away from the creative industry. I didn't want to work in the creative industry. I didn't want to be creative anymore. I wanted to stop questioning everything and just kind of be more black and white about stuff. And what happened when I did that, I found that more of my friends and colleagues came to me and said, hey man, we've heard you've been doing this psychology thing, I need help. And these were people who were like really, really successful, who at front page of campaign, all that kind of stuff, they were hard, they were bulletproof, all of that kind of thing. But I thought, why is an industry that on the surface of things has got so much glamour, so much going good for it, it's 2012 when we're talking, what's going on? Why are these people coming to me and saying, I'm breaking down? I can't handle the pressure, I'm stressed out, I'm anxious, I'm divorcing, etc., etc. So I thought, is it just me attracting those type of people, which would have been a worry, or is there an issue? And I remember trying to get this this study out through some of the press, and at the time, I mean, people are talking about it now a bit more, which is good, but when I did it back in 2012, no one was talking about this stuff, and I pitched it to a few different places. And the response absolutely shocked me. And the response was this: we can't put that in our publication because it will spook our clients out.
Wow.
I thought, that's going to make me even more, being a creative person, I thought, right, I'm even more determined now. That's worrying. So I remember putting this study out, and it actually went global, actually. And there's people from Australia and UK and Europe and America, etc. Probably about 300 people I kind of like replied to it, probably within 24 hours, which is more of a shock anyway. They were so quick to reply to. I was basically looking at what's the emotional state of our industry right now for creative leaders. Some of the stats that came back, and this is back in 2012, so it'll be, I would imagine, pretty much more stark now. Here's some stats. 92% of those leaders said they were stressed out and anxious. 68% said they were angry and insecure. 65% found undervalued and disengaged. 56% said they'd been burnt out. And 21% they hadn't been burnt out yet.
Wow. I mean,
there's a problem.
Yeah, that's a huge problem. I mean, I was going to ask you, I think just as a basic thing, and maybe that's where we'd kind of got to with what you just said, is that what do you see as the major things that keep coming up for you from people? And I know this, I know you read out those four or five things, but are there things within that you see time and time again, and either they've been getting worse, or they've always been there, or they're particularly creative people? What kind of things do you see as symptomatic of the way things are set up, and the people who go in there, and the combination of the context and the industry? What are the most common problems?
Insecurity is the big one. I say it falls down to insecurity. What am I doing? Why the hell am I doing it? And have I got a chance of staying in this for the long haul? Either because am I going to be switched out, or am I going to burn myself out? So I think that's the big thing that's happened. And if you look at all those things about stress, anxiety, we all talk about let's reduce stress, let's reduce anxiety, let's reduce anger, etc. You need to really stop talking about those kind of words. That's a symptom.
Right.
What's actually happened is all of these people's brains are soaked in fear. If we look at stress is the symptom. It's the physical, it's adrenaline and cortisol. You want to look behind that and go, okay, so, and we tend to hero worship stress, not just in our industry. I mean, it's pretty rife across most industries now. But what you have to say is that, are you willing to live a stressed out life? And people will kind of go, yeah, it's for great work. But if you get that same audience, you say, are you willing to live your life in fear? No one will put their hand up. So I think what the core thing is that people are scared. Am I good enough? Am I still relevant? Do people fear me as a creative person? All of these kind of things, this is what's coming out. It's the insecurity. It's the kind of like lack of clarity, focus, insecurity. That's what seems to be driving a lot of people. And how can I become better?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's definitely lots to be said for that. It's funny, when you first said insecure, my immediate reaction was you were talking about a sort of imposter syndrome. And I know there's all the other things you just said, like an insecurity, an instability, maybe, of not thinking you've got a job for life, which is obviously something that's happening in loads of different industries. I mean, journalism's, you know, been shot to death, even worse than advertising. But I kind of thought that there was a sort of weird sort of extra layer of mentality behind there, where you're kind of going, am I even worthy of doing this, whether it's spending people's money or trying to persuade people? Is that imposter syndrome part of it at all, or am I going too far down the rabbit hole?
No, imposter syndrome is part of it, because it's that thing, am I going to get caught out? If it's that, am I relevant, am I good enough, etc., etc., will people catch me out? Imposter syndrome tends to happen more as you kind of climb the ranks, so kind of as people get higher and higher up and become more kind of leadership levels, they start getting more of the imposter syndrome. But the reality is, we make this big thing about imposter syndrome. Everyone has it. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of like, yeah, okay, get over it. Do you know what I mean? Yes, you are good enough. And that's why we need to start changing. And that's what I do with a lot of the work, is to start getting people to realign with what their core unconscious values are, and getting people to kind of go, okay, so what limiting belief is fueling the imposter syndrome? Because what happens with imposter syndrome is that behind imposter syndrome, there's always going to be a limiting belief, like I'm not good enough, for example. And what happens is kind of like a roller coaster when you're on it. So if you have an unconscious belief that I'm not good enough, what you try and do, you work really, really hard. So you go, I am good enough, I am good enough, I am good enough, I am good enough, I am good enough. But then your brain gets a thing called cognitive dissonance, which it doesn't like to be not right.
Right.
That's when we start self-sabotaging. So we self-sabotage it so that we go down that kind of roller coaster ride again. And then we get close enough to I'm not good enough. Then we go, no, I am good enough, I am good enough, I am good enough, I am good enough. Then cognitive dissonance kicks in, and then we start self-sabotaging. Then we bring it back down again until we go, oh, no, but I am good enough. It's why people lose money as well. I'm not worthy of this money. Yes, I am. Yes, I am. Yes, I am. Yes, I am. Oh, not that much. Self-sabotage. Spend it, spend it, spend it. Oh, but I don't want to be broke again. So you want to get to what's that core belief on that.
That's so amazing, because I think we're all aware of that. Maybe not just in how good we are as creatives, but I think, you know, if you were writing a screenplay, you kind of... Yeah. I think creativity requires a really difficult mixture of humility and arrogance, where you've got to go, I am good enough to, it is worth me pursuing this thing creatively. And at the same time going, I've got to really do a good job here and work hard, because otherwise it's going to be shit. So you kind of have those two things kind of clashing with each other simultaneously, when they're going, I am good enough, I'm not good enough, I am good enough, I'm not good enough. And it's having that going on in your head the whole time, as for any creative, is a really tricky thing, particularly if you're not recognizing that's what's going on. But I didn't realize it was sort of a almost like having a limiter on a Ferrari, where you've gone this far, actually no, you've now got to go back the other way. Because I just thought it was like for my own thing, when that's happened, I've kind of gone, I'm the kind of person who, you know, gets to about 8 or 9 out of 10 and then kind of stops or pulls back or doesn't do the extra thing that's required to go through the roof and go 10 out of 10. So I've always thought, like, is that just like me as a person? I don't mean like it's not changeable, but I mean that what happened to me to think that I almost don't want to reach that final level of success, because once you get there, what else is there? Like, you can get to the top of the mountain and realize, oh shit, there's nothing, it's not what I was hoping or expecting it to be, and then everything falls apart.
Yeah, it's two things. It's the rags to riches to rags again, essentially, to riches to rags. That's what's happening. So that's where people, I don't want to be broke. I'm not going to be broke, self-sabotage, blah, 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 until you go, oh, God, I can't be broke, and you get up again. But there's the other side of that, which is, it is like a self-limiter. So when people set goals, for example, it's been taught really, really badly. So we set a goal to reach a certain point. Now, we fear success. And one of the things we fear success, but then we forget that. Well, then what? So what you want to do is, when you set goals, it's like, I want that or better. And I remember when I left advertising, when I did the NLP training, one of the first things I learned was a thing called timeline therapy, and how you project yourself into the future to go, what is it that you really want? One of the big things, this is humans across the board, is that we know what we don't want, we don't know what we do want. So if you ask most people, what do you want? They'll say, I don't want to be stressed, I want less anxiety, I want better relationships, I don't want to be broke, etc. But you go, what do you want? A lot of people hit a stumbling block. They haven't thought about that since they were 16 at school. So that's part of the problem. So what do you want to do? You want to shatter that glass ceiling. So when you set goals, you want to go and go, okay. So for me, it was like, okay, I want to leave advertising. I want to have this career helping people. I want to inspire people who inspire me. And I want this life where I live in the hot country, have a pool and a villa and all that kind of stuff, clean the pool every day, annoying as hell. But then I guess, and then after that, I want to be doing, I want to be doing trainings, and after that, then I want to be writing a book, et cetera, et cetera. So you don't want to put that self-limiter on yourself, but also, you've got to make sure that all parts of your personality are in 100% alignment with what you want. Because you might set a goal that a part of you wants, and maybe a lot of you wants, but there's a small part of you that doesn't want. That's why people can't stop smoking. Because they go, a large part of them goes, I want to be a non-smoker. But there's a part of them, that subconscious smoker, that won't let you stop. So you need to kind of go, okay, so what parts could sabotage this and get those parts of you in alignment as well?
But that's the tricky thing. It's like if you're not a mechanic, asking you to kind of go, well, what's the thing? Is it the carburetor that's wrong here? But I don't know how to deal with that. Like, I don't know how to even find which part of my brain is sabotaging my non-smoking thing. Is it because I want to be a rebel? And how do I find that out? And how do I stop wanting to be a rebel?
So for example, if it's smoking, for example, just as an example, when you started smoking, your brain believed it was doing you for a good thing. It was smoking for a good reason. Maybe to look cool. Maybe to not look cool. Maybe to be part of the crowd. Maybe to not be part of the crowd. Maybe to look older than you were. Maybe to look younger than you were, etc. Maybe to skip school, etc. That part of you is frozen. So as you get older and older, you get older and you get more conscious and go, well, consciously, I know that I shouldn't be smoking, it's bad for me. But, so you go, I'm going to consciously stop. But your unconscious brain is far, 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 far more powerful than your conscious brain. So you say, I'm going to consciously stop, but you can't. You keep going back to it. It's the same with anything. That's why we have limits when we're in our careers. It's kind of like, well, I want to be global chief creative officer of this thing that I've created. But if there's a part of you that actually doesn't think you deserve that, or doesn't believe that you're capable of that, or someone from that background isn't able to have that kind of thing, you'll get close to it until the cognitive dissonance is too great, and then it will pull you back and the self-sabotage will happen. So if you want to find those parts, that's when you have to work with someone like me who specializes in work with the unconscious brain. You'll find a lot of coaches, a lot of therapists and all that kind of stuff will work with the cognitive stuff. Like I've trained in cognitive behavioral therapy just because I'm kind of obsessive about all of the stuff. It only works if you combine it with the unconscious stuff, because if you want something consciously, you'd have already done it if there wasn't an unconscious thing stopping it.
Yeah, that's a good point. So a lot of what you do, obviously, is with creative leaders, and I think that's partly because a coach is an expense, and we can go back, 20 minutes to go, the money side of advertising isn't what it was. And I think that in a lot of agencies, that kind of thing is seen as not an indulgence, but like, it's further down the list of priorities for where the money should go. So I've been lucky enough to be in a bunch of agencies over the years that have prioritized it, maybe not to the extent that your particular specialism exists, but maybe in various bits of coaching and bits of help and continuing to kind of, at least progress who you are and whether it's your craft or the way that you act as a person in the company or that kind of stuff. Do you see that? I mean, obviously, you'll say that we should all have what you're doing, and I'd agree with you there. But it tends to be for creative leaders, and there's something that we should be teaching this from an earlier age, I feel.
Yeah.
Do you think that's the case? And is there a practical way that could come about?
Yeah, I mean, I think this would be taught from when you're in school, Jay. If you if you're a kid and you knew how your brain really operated from a really young age, I think you'd get. I mean, look at the statistics now about children with depression and suicide, and all, it's pretty horrible. If we knew how it worked then, I think there'd be a lot less problems. I think that's, I mean, that's kind of also why I do work with students, and that's for free and stuff when I do trainings and things, because they do need it and they do want it, and actually they're more open to it. It's quite hard if you're kind of been on the planet for quite a long time. It's quite it takes a lot of courage to kind of go, I need help.
Yeah.
To be honest.
Yeah.
So I think the earlier we can get this in, 100% the better. 100%. But there'll be a lot less problems, a lot less burnout happening, because people will actually know, actually, it's not all about me, for a start.
Yeah. Because I think in some ways you're being the cure rather than the prevention. And I think when you've got to a creative leadership level, and you either haven't been prepped for it or you've been prepped for it in a certain way. But my problem often with coaching is that when you've got in that room and it's been great, you're like, wow, yeah, and that makes so much sense. And you're ready to go and you fiddle a little booklet with little lovely sentences that make loads of sense. And then a month or two later, it's not there. It's far enough away that it might as well not have happened. Do you have any way of mitigating that as a situation as well?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, that's part of the problem with most coaching and most training, is that it doesn't stick. I mean, it goes through with training. You can send like a company on a training day or a training weekend or whatever, but 9 times out of 10, when we're under stress and pressure, we revert back to old patterns of behaviour. It's just the way our brains do stuff, like to preserve energy. It's also because you're learning this stuff at a conscious cognitive level. And a lot of coaching is cognitive and conscious. A lot of training is cognitive and conscious.
Yeah.
The problem is, that's not what drives us. Here's a mad thing is that 95% of your waking life is on autopilot. 95% of your waking life is on autopilot. So if you haven't reprogrammed that autopilot, you haven't reprogrammed that unconscious part, that subconscious part, 95% of the time, you're going to be reverting back to old patterns of behavior, old ways of thinking, old ways of communicating, old ways of doing. You really need to get into the unconscious, and you need to change that stuff. You need to change the blueprint, essentially. Otherwise, you're operating from the same old blueprint, and you will forget it. We all will, because stuff gets in the way, and we get busy, and we've only got so much we can fit in our little tiny conscious brain. Which, if you look at the conscious brain, the unconscious brain, the conscious brain, if you look metaphorically, it's about the size of an inch cube. If you look at the size of the unconscious brain, metaphorically, it's the size of the Milky Way.
Yeah.
So if you drop a little inch cube in the Milky Way, you think that makes much of a dent.
Absolutely. So you're writing this book. So tell us first all about it, and second, the whole thing about wanting people to pre-order it. Because I think it's really important that we get this kind of stuff out there and that this book exists. So, I mean, first, you don't have to do the plugging bit at the beginning, but you do reasonably want a practical thing to happen to bring it into existence. But tell us about what it's going to be and what it could solve and how it could contribute to the industry.
Yes, so basically it's a book that's kind of combined 20 plus years of working in the industry, so being in that fire pit and kind of knowing what it takes to kind of survive it. It's combining that with that decades plus work of psychological training, and also 7 years of working one-to-one with some of the most smartest, sharpest, creative brains on the planet. I mean, so what, with people all over the world on Skype, like we're doing now. So it's combining all of that stuff to kind of go, okay, so what can we practically do? Because we can talk about mental health, we can talk about wellness in the industry, et cetera, until the cows come home. But what we have to do as creatives, we need to take responsibility for our own brain. The reality we have is that the madness is going to keep going on around us. I don't see us changing that industry fast enough. And if you're waiting to be saved, it's probably better just to get out of the boat or start pressure-proofing your own brain and start going, okay, so how can I rediscover my sense of self? How can I rediscover my passion for what I do? How can I rediscover my purpose, what I do? And all that stuff we're talking about with how do we start finding what parts are self-sabotaging, what we want in life, how do we start finding what those limiting beliefs are and start getting rid of those limiting beliefs that are, frankly, from childhood and still keeping us, holding us back? How can we start finding them and start removing them so that we can totally and utterly unleash that full potential that we have inside of us? And I think the big thing is that what we want to do with the book, and what I do with my clients, is that I take people from being at the effect of stuff. It's not me, it's her, it's not me, it's him, it's not me, it's the industry, it's not me, it's the client, it's not me, it's the brief, to the cause of the way we're feeling. If we go, I'm stressed out or anxious because of X, Y, and Z, we ain't going to change it. But if you start empowering people by going, I'm stressing myself out because of X, Y, and Z, at least you can start changing it. And I say this thing, which is basically, if you're a tree and you have no roots and the wind blows, which it will, you can't blame the wind falling over.
That makes perfect sense. Yeah, so what's it going to... Is it a practical guide for all of us? Is it more for leaders? Is it going to be for people outside the advertising industry as well?
Yeah, so it's basically, it's a book that's, it's going to be, primary audience is going to be creative leaders. That's where most of my work is. It's most of the stuff I work with. The reality is, and I call it for high-achieving creative leaders and those on their way. Like, if I wish I had this book and this information and all this stuff I know now, I wish I had it when I was 20. Because I would have probably done better work than I'd done, and I would probably have burned less relationships, I'd have burned less brain cells, I'd have kind of probably drunk less alcohol, etc., etc. The stuff I wish I'd known then, it will make you a better leader, and it will make you better prepared to be a better leader.
Okay, I mean, that's great. And so what is the practical thing you need people to do in terms of the publishing process?
Yeah, so basically, it's a strange old thing, publishing, is that what you need to do to get a book seen by major publishers, like, for example, Penguin, etc., is you need to prove pre-orders first. If you get enough pre-orders, they see there's a demand for the book, and then they will look at it, and they will kind of probably take it on if there's a big demand. So what I need to do, and it's on a site called Publishizer.com with a Z, and essentially... people go on that site, there's a video on there, it's a 2-minute video that kind of explains what the book's about and why it's important. Some very cool friends of mine on there as well, chatting about it. Tells you about a synopsis about it, where each chapter unpacks. And then if enough people pre-order it, I think it's basically, I need at least 100 by, I think, 20 days from now. So by the end of August. And if you get more, you get higher and higher to bigger and bigger publishers. So basically, it's as many as you get is how you get a better publisher. If that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think that's a good sort of meritocratic way of doing it. So this is and anyone who's listening who wants to see this book, this is your chance to actually do something right now to have it come about, which I think is quite an unusual opportunity. So I mean, I think we could all do it. It's one of those things that once it exists. Should be in the shelf space, although no one's got shelf space anymore. Everyone's got a locker and 18 inches of desk. So wherever you put your little books, the shrinking creative library, that people can then have that. Because it's crazy that this issue exists, and it's a big, complicated, difficult issue, and the resources to tackle it are never going to be enough because... you know, people will always want to spend money on other things or kick back to the shareholders or whatever the hell else is going on. So this isn't going to get dealt with, and it's going to get worse. And I think when you look around at society right now, you're looking at something that's less and less stable, and there's probably people here thinking, how am I going to make my mortgage? How am I going to... I'll give you an example. I think I put this in a blog or something recently, that I'm sitting here as someone who's 44 in the industry, and I'm going, you know, my... The pyramid is getting smaller and smaller as you get up, partly with leadership, partly with age. There are fewer and fewer jobs as you get older. If you're still working past 40, good. If you're still working past 50, it's almost a miracle. And if you're working past 60, that's a ridiculous, like, one in a million situation in advertising at the moment. But you've got to live, probably, with medical science being what it is, and assuming we don't have the heat death of planet Earth in the next couple of years or whatever, you might then have to live another 30, 40, 50 years. And it's not just about necessarily having the money, but I can understand how people are going, shit, what am I doing? But the thing was, I had lunch with another friend of mine you know, a couple of months ago, and he was feeling the same thing at the age of 35. He was going, my card's going to be marked pretty soon. I'm going to be too expensive. I'm going to be too much of an indulgence. I'm not going to be needed. And I'm 35. So what do you do at 35? Is in a world of increasing automation, in a world where you won't even be able to drive Uber in a couple of years because all the cars will be driving themselves. I think the overall feeling of this insecurity, and can we do something about it, and can you feel empowered enough that you are worthy and you can be the one who can solve these problems? You can be the one to strike out on your own and have your own ad agency. You can be the one to change the industry from the kind of mess it's getting itself into to something else. And, you know, having a book like this can help to either unpick the sort of mental stresses that are going on or the limiter that we were talking about earlier. And I think to help this book along into existence would be a tiny step in a right direction that's really, really necessary for this industry and many other creative industries.
Brilliant where it's coming up. And that's the thing, isn't it? Change your beliefs, you change your life. If you want to have that agency of your own, you want to believe you're capable of it, you want to know what beliefs might be holding that back, what parts of me might be holding that back. So you want to get rid of that stuff. If you've got truly do have these goals, these ambitions, awesome. If you want to be one of those people who actually make those things a reality, you can't just focus on, okay, I'm going to have this, I'm going to have my own agency. You want to go, what could potentially stop me? What inside of me right now will block that? What will sabotage that? So I think the big thing to look at is pressure-proofing your brain is future-proofing your career, essentially. And you can't have a career if your brain's a pile of mush. And we don't look after it. And we don't really know what's knocking about inside of it. And we really need to.
All that makes a huge amount of sense. The one thing I was going to then say was, is there anything else you wanted to kind of add as we wind this up?
This is my way of kind of, not, as we said a bit earlier, is that not everybody can afford coaching, but everyone can afford, well, not everyone can afford, that's a silly thing to say, but a lot of people can afford $21 to start going, to get something that's a practical manual for surviving the stuff you're going through. A practical manual is actually going to unlock your full potential, so you don't sit on there and kind of go, oh, what might have been? Or, scarily, you don't sit there at 36 and kind of think, what the hell am I going to do right now? And I think that's a lot of things that happen with a lot of my clients, is that they a lot of them are in their 40s, and they're kind of, they've got a lot of outgoings, and they're thinking, what next? I haven't even thought this far, because we set that bar, that ceiling, at a certain thing we're going to achieve by a certain age. But what we didn't realise was the world would change around us. This helps you to prepare for that, helps you to get way ahead of that game, essentially, and create better work and lead better and just be happier. Got to be a good thing.
Absolutely. I don't think anyone could really argue with that. And I think it's just worth also saying thanks to you for at least providing this as an option, as something that could be there to be helpful for us in the future, because it's weird how many things and what things we need as human beings that just aren't provided. And yet, you know, it seems like people in society want to spend a long time providing things that really aren't any good for us. So, yeah, I mean, you know, it's great that your work's out there. And I'll leave details of how to get in touch with you and stuff like that on the blog post that goes with this. But yeah, it's been great having a chat with you, Matt. And
thank you.
We'll keep in touch, and please let me know how things are going. And I wish you lots of luck with the book.
Thank you very much, mate. It's been an absolute pleasure chatting to you, finally.
Yes, finally. Okay, well, have a lovely time in Mallorca, and don't get sunburnt. And I'll speak to you soon.
Awesome, mate. Thank you very much.
Cheers, Matt.
Good to see you, mate.
Thanks, bye.
If this is a podcast, then what's Christmas?